podcast was a mess.
Welcome to the Wildlife Herd Podcast. It's been a little while since we've been here, and glad to be back. We both have been busy with meetings and travel and all kinds of stuff, so we're finally happy to get back in here and do some recording. We decided today we'd talk a little bit about Endangered Species Act and some things that have been going on recently with some critters that either up for listing or been delisted. A lot of things going on, and try to clear up some of that and why it's important. I guess we can start a little bit with what is the Endangered Species Act?
Yeah, I'll let you have at it.
So 1973 is basically the primary law for protecting and conserving imperiled species. It was designed to, and I'll do a quote, protect critically imperiled species from extinction as a consequence of economic growth and development untempered by adequate concern and conservation. So basically, all the
same as mine.
Yeah, exactly. All the stuff that people do, development, economics, all that stuff, causes a lot of species to lose habitat and want to protect those species from going extinct, basically.
Thanks to progress.
Yes.
Yeah.
So as, I think some of the rulings and discussions through Congress and all was basically they wanted to recover species to the point where they no longer needed a law's protection. And that includes the ecosystems on which they depend. And then there's a weird kind of, I don't know what you, how you say it, something that confuses a lot of people is take. So where it's illegal to harm, harass, and hunt these species. And I think that's a lot of what people get kind of stuck on is what constitutes take. We could talk a little bit about that as we go through some of the species.
Yeah, because it changes.
So why is ESA important?
Well, it gives us some sort of ability to legally act when a species is in peril. So if we know someone's doing something to harm or threaten that animal and its habitat, mostly on public lands, I mean, it helps us to do something about it. But, you know, when it's on public lands, it gets a little tricky
how it's handled. And that's why a lot of what we've done, you know, you mentioned the ESA is a little bit younger than you are, but with the red cockaded woodpecker, which I call RCW, you know, it kind of was one of the first species to be listed, and we are just now downlisting it. So it could be a long process. But in the meantime, after some of their habitat destruction had happened in reaction to the, we were able to work with landowners and put in things called safe harbor. So you could still maintain your land, keep working the land, and even restore the land and not be penalized if that bird came back. And that's kind of been the model moving forward, how different species were handled under the endangered species. But there's been a lot of misses and but, you know, there's also been a bunch of wins. So it's helped get people together. It's helped focus funding. It has been a tool to justify funding being put in places. It's helped us protect a lot of different areas, species that were listed or candidate species for listing. So a couple of the species we'll talk about today, a lot of work has been done in their name. A lot of land has been protected. Jobs for people. I mean, that's something that's often overlooked is the, you know, economics of all of this and protecting species and just stewarding what we should be stewarding the land. It's all related. So that's kind of a long-winded, not really answer to your question. But hey,
It's a complicated topic. It's a complicated bill or law, but it is important to protect the species from going extinct. And we lost passenger pigeons and dusky seaside sparrows and, you know, other species out there that Right. And so if we hadn't done something, estimations are that about 227 species would have gone extinct without the ESA, Endangered Species Act. There are a lot of criticisms about the Endangered Species Act because what they consider Species Recovery Act is only 2% of those that are actually listed. But at the same time, we haven't seen all these species go extinct. So we are protecting them. And that was the goal of the act, was to stop this species from going extinct. That was the main purpose. So we have definitely done that. yes, we haven't been able to bring a lot of them off of that list yet, but we have had some that are, you know, Bald Eagle being, you know, a good example of that.
Yeah, that's a great example of how it kind of forced action on an industry to change a product, you know, in terms of DDT impact eggs and things like that.
Yeah, for a lot of species. So, you know, any bird that was impacting there.
Yeah, it's kind of helped us, you know, put that, like I said, the funding towards investigating what's going on with species. Why are we seeing declines? Because in many cases, there wouldn't be a funding mechanism. And, you know, there's not a ton of money, but it helps garner, you know, donations and fundraising activities for species. It brings more awareness to the species. So we talk a lot more about species that are on the endangered species list or are candidates, you know, people that tends to be the animals that people end up knowing about and hopefully more apt to fight for. And a lot of those species are helping other animals that are on the ground as well.
So I'm sure a lot of species like red-cockaded woodpecker, for one, would probably not be recognized or much known about it from the general public if it was a listed species. Yes. Now, people who are outside of its range probably still don't really know anything about it. But those who are in, you know, the South, where they are prevalent or necessarily prevalent, there are some areas now, thanks to some recovery efforts, probably no one would really know about that bird if it wasn't for the fact that it was listed. Now, it did cause some heartburn for a lot of landowners early on.
Landowners took it into their own hands, too. We lost a lot of birds just due to bad information and information not getting out in a quick and clear way. We learned a lot, I think, as a field when that happened. And, you know, it still happens. So, you know, when other species were getting listed, you know, people have the knee-jerk reaction. They panic. They're worried about their land being taken away, which isn't how it works. You know, so they do what they can to get that species off their land or the chance that that animal would be on their land. You know, plant species are removed from the land, hoping that animal, trees are cut down, holes are buried, you know, or filled in. And it can be rough when you're not reaching out to the citizens and landowners that might not quite understand what's happening. That's really overall not going to impact them too much. When it boils down to it.
Yeah. Early on, yes, there were some issues with it that probably did cause a lot of problems. But since there have, and that was some of the criticisms with the ESA, was that there was not a lot of flexibility on the implementation. But there are a lot of new landowner agreements out there that provide what they call regulatory predictability, like you mentioned, safe harbor agreements. Mm-hmm. Those sort of things are now in place. And so that gives those landowners the protection to do what they need to do on their property within reason and still provide habitat for that species. Because the goal was not to take away revenue or the use of the property in any way. There's, you know, Congress has done a good bit of it and making some changes, but at the same time, there's complaints too that it gives sometimes too much leeway from industry, and then there's still complaints that there's not enough still, even with the changes. It doesn't allow certain areas to do mining or drilling or sort of things. But I mean, they're limited ecosystems and a lot of species impacted in that. So I think there's a pretty good balance now if you look at the different predictability and agreements and stuff that are available to the landowners.
Yeah, you know, and really there has to be a balance in use. And we need to start thinking about what we're going to set aside and what we're going to save and preserve, because none of this lasts forever. The lands that have been potentially protected by endangered species or, you know, candidate species, if that gets developed, I mean, ultimately it hurts everybody. So a lot of this land that is being protected provides an important ecosystem service, is what you're get referred to. So our soil quality, water quality, you know, it all plays into our daily activities and our daily helps. You know, people are so focused on the animal, and we probably need to do a better job at explaining how it plays into the overall health of the planet.
Yeah, because it's not just, like you said, species that benefit, soil, water, other species that are just somehow related to those species, may depend upon them, like gopher tortoise. And so there's a whole lot of other species that may not even be listed that benefit from protection of the species. And then you come into economics, and you protect those species, and you know, just some of them from hunting, which is brings economics in. If you can restore those species, like sandhill cranes, that brings new revenue in for people as well. When you can bring those species off the list and allow them to be back to their, what does this say, normal levels at sustainable levels.
Right. And you also look at other income producers, like just birding. You know, people will travel from across the country to see a rare or endangered species that pops up somewhere. You know, ecotourism is huge. Yeah. And of course, your charismatic endangered species are sometimes really high on the list.
Yeah.
We hate that people wait until, you know, they're getting close to gone, but it's also something important to think about is the value there also.
Yeah.
You know, so if they're blanking out, we're going to lose a big source of income.
Yeah.
Just from being able to go see them.
There's definitely, you know, a lot of reasons why it's important. And as we've already kind of begun to touch on a little bit, is there's issues with it. And some of the issues where there's not enough focus on species recovery within the ESA, because a lot of times you hear that, is that they don't do a lot of emphasis on it when Supreme Court says, you know, Congress's intent of the act was to halt and reverse the trend toward species extinction, no matter what the cost was. And we're only seeing a 2% recovery rate if you look at all the species that are listed. But like I said, prevented an estimated 227 of them from going extinct. So there's definitely benefit. Yes, there does need to be a lot more done, but the resources aren't there with right. species recovery. And that's where all that comes
their from. Their funding is not there at all. And that's where it comes back to us, you know, as landowners and as stewards, is just to take some of it out, you know, reduce our use, you know, and make room for these things. Because, you know, once they're gone, that's it. And then we start, you know, avalanche of impacts from certain species being kicked out of the system.
Yeah.
You know, look at what's going on, you know, with wolves and some of those top predators, you know, being out of the system now.
Right.
You've got a lot of nuisance animals because, you know, they've lost habitat because we didn't get on a listing fast enough or habitat protection fast enough. Just impacts in other ways. And then they become expensive in other ways.
Yeah.
It might have just been cheaper to set aside some land than having to deal with them now in your neighborhood or mitigation, what have you. You know, moving them around, there's so many translocations in the name of a listing, or and it's just it's all expensive. Translocations, relocations, introductions.
Yeah, and then getting people, you know, changing that mindset when you're wanting to put, say, like you said, wolves, a predator, back into an area where they've been gone for so long, and you're going to get a lot of pushback because people don't want a predator in their backyard if they've not had one in the past. So if they've always been there, you're kind of used to it, but putting an animal back in where they haven't been, and especially one that's as controversial as a lot of the predators are, that is expensive and it's hard to do.
Yeah, and my big thing too is, you know, they blinked out of that area for a reason. Have we adequately addressed why they were gone to begin with?
Yeah.
And that usually boils down to available habitat, you know, available connected. Mm-hmm. So you might have a corridor, but is it adequate for whatever critter you're trying to put back out on the landscape? Or, you know, it's an experiment sometimes.
And that's the one that monarch probably falls into. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of emphasis on monarchs right now because
we're waiting. Yep.
We'll see what's going to happen with that. But that's habitat, and that connected habitat, like you were saying, because they're not just in one area. They've got to have that migratory path coming through overwintering areas, which is a lot of what they're losing now, is that overwintering and everything in between.
Yep.
There's resources looking at preventing those. And that's one thing people are doing now, is trying to keep species from being put on the list, because that makes things easier.
Yeah.
From a management standpoint and an economic standpoint.
It's much better being proactive. All of this.
Right. So there's a lot of money going into monarchs right now from different groups and organizations, but it benefits multiple species
for sure
when you're doing that. So restoring that habitat. And monarchs are, you know, just one of the many pollinators that are threatened or, you know, on decline in some way or another, but they're very important.
Oh, yeah. I mean, their life history is what makes them so popular. Like, they have an amazing story. Their, you know, migration, and, you know, a lot of people think of migratory animals, think of the big game out west, which is also, they're working on a number of initiatives for them out there too. But, you know, Monarch, we have a chance to really push it, I think, just because it's charismatic and there's a lot of cool initiatives going on.
And all the kids learn about monarchs and the life cycle and the migration in school. So that's an easy one, as I call kind of a poster child, that we use Bob Whites and gopher tortoises and monarchs as kind of a poster child, because it's a whole lot easier to commit someone to manage for a species that's cute or cuddly or relatable in some way or another, instead of some mole cricket or, you know, a little darter that nobody ever sees. So we use those species, again, as a poster child to garner funding, interest, and then they benefit a whole lot of other species. So one of the other issues, or some of the other issues, we're talking about listings and stuff, was what they call consultation delays. So there's a lot of species that are waiting to see if they're going to go on the list.
Yep.
And we just got some information on gopher tortoise, I think, recently.
So there's another lawsuit going in. A group feels strongly that they should have been listed. So now that's going to have to force the Fish and Wildlife Service to review it, most likely the lawsuit. So yeah, gopher tortoise has been a tough one. We've known it's been coming for a while now, which resources were put into it. We're out counting tortoises for the last, I don't know, it feels like 20 years. But I mean, it's been pretty close. Trying to just count where they are, decide how many populations we need on the landscape for them to survive, quote, in perpetuity, or, you know, so they don't blink out anytime soon. States have had programs to move them around, save them. Florida has been moving and relocating tortoises for years now. So a lot of effort has gone into being proactive in hopes that they wouldn't get listed, but it's questionable.
Yeah.
They've greatly declined in a lot of states. And
yeah,
we'll see.
They've done a pretty good job with tortoises, populations that have been protected through this and that effort to.
A lot of land has been purchased.
So that's good that's come out of that and trying to get it off the list.
And that's actually, you know, in Georgia, for instance, land, as you've said, has been purchased, and that's provided more opportunity, more public land opportunity, right, in the name of tortoises. Right. So a good part of it.
Yeah. So a lot of people benefit. You know, we already touched a little bit about Monarch. So what have you heard recently with Monarch? We're just kind of waiting to hear on them as well.
We're just waiting to hear on it. I think it's going to happen. People are definitely preparing for it. We've had programs out there for it, encouraging landowners to, you know, set some land aside. Keep the plants that they rely on the landscape. Milkweed is the one that's most commonly talked about. We've heard about people removing milkweed from their farms and from their fields and hope, you know, not being a spot for monarchs. But their path is very well known where they go. It's just, I think the important part there is some of our chemical use and some of those things. So I think, you know, part of the hope is looking at how it impacts eagles with some of that regulation. Yeah, it's going to make things a little bit more expensive. We're going to regulate some. But again, look at it as a human health thing. I mean, if you have something that's on the landscape wiping out your insect population, your, you know, butterflies.
And somebody will eventually develop something that works just as well, but with less issues. And mm-hmm. There'll always be some new chemical on the market.
Well, and that's the win-win, too, is kind of encouraging quicker research on some of this stuff.
Yeah. And then there was a recent decision on a change for red-cockaded woodpeckers.
Yes, they were downlisted. Again, you know, we still work very hard on those woodpecker populations, but where we focused on them, they've been moved around because they, you know, put their nests or in cavities or a cavity. So we actually have to drill there and put boxes. Artificial boxes, nests in there, in trees. So that's been a lot of effort. But, you know, those where we've done that, populations have boomed. We've been able to move those birds around. So this sounds terrible, but they're basically extra birds, you know, and they fill out where they are. So we move them to new places and they establish new populations. And they've been very successful on a lot of places.
Yeah.
They've even started creating their new nesting cavities, which is a huge deal. It does take some time, but there are suitable trees in some places. But on the flip side, every time there's a hurricane, you know, we have to go into triage mode and replace nest boxes and just go and to full out call everybody all hands on deck. You know, I came out of RCW retirement during Michael to help out with the effort, and I hadn't climbed trees in a couple of years. But so I'm not sure if they're ready. We'll find out. You know, they met the list of requirements to be downlisted, so they still have some protections. And that's the other thing, when it's already in the system, already kind of being thought about and studied, we're monitoring them, it can go up or down. You know, Woodstork's another one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing them all over the place now.
So, and to explain, downlisting is basically taking them from a danger status down to a threatened status. And then sometimes, if you're lucky, taking them off the list altogether from threatened to, you know.
Yeah, that's the goal, completely off. And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand is, as a wildlife biologist, we don't want to see our animals listed or anything listed. It makes things a little bit harder. People don't understand what the Endangered Species Act is. So it's a level of fear. What if I have this on my property? You know, people stop working with us when they know they have that animal out there. And sometimes it hurts more than it helps until we can get that outreach going. But, you know, we want to be as proactive as possible to prevent them from being listed, which is why with a number of our bird species, especially upland bird species, we're really ramping up a lot of conservation efforts. Mm-hmm. Grasslands is a huge deal. Like, if we don't start setting aside conserving our grasslands, we're going to be in trouble. And it's going to be the same type of thing with wetlands. You know, we were seeing decline and degradation of wetlands. So we had a lot of conservation focused on wetland easements, restoration, protection. And I think it's time. We're going to have to do the same ones because they're blinking out. Again, that's our soil quality, and our uplands filter our water for our water quality. So it's we're at that pivotal moment that we have to act for a whole biome at this point.
Yeah. And that's what people don't realize, is not just animal species can become threatened or endangered, but whole ecosystems could be considered threatened and endangered.
That's right.
There may not be a listing technically for them, but, you know, we're losing longleaf pine ecosystems, grassland ecosystems. All of those are in decline, and the species that rely on those are the ones that get put on the list.
Yep.
And it all comes down to the ecosystem.
Yep.
If we can work with the landowners and get those off the list, like you said, that gives you more flexibility. And when you're in, especially eastern states like Georgia, and you're 93% privately owned, you have to work with those private landowners to maintain those species, because we do not have nowhere near enough public land in order to maintain them for long term. In some cases, we may not own property that has that species on it. We see that with some of the plant species.
Oh, yeah.
And they're only found in certain private properties. And thankfully, you know, most of the time those landowners are willing to work, but not always.
Not always, but I mean, a lot of times, especially, you know, I would think a landowner, oh, they're not going to go for this. They surprise you and get really excited, and they become that species' biggest advocate, you know, and are working right alongside us to protect it. Because, I mean, in general, people want good things for their land.
And so delays in consultation, there's always a group somewhere that's got a list of species that they think should be listed and or considered. And so there's lawsuits that go on all the time, which I'm not so sure I'm completely for all the lawsuit kind of stuff, because I think that ties up a lot of stuff too and causes some of the delays that they're actually fighting. So
it makes it more expensive.
Yeah. And there's sometimes that price. Yeah. So sometimes, yes, they probably do need to push it, but I think at other times they probably go a little too far. And it's one of those, it's really hard to tell, but there is an enormous list of species waiting.
It is. And that's why I think, you know, we're in a moment that we need to look at biome efforts and just conserving what we can and saying, look, we want to conserve this land because it's a biodiversity hotspot. It checks these boxes for species. And I'm not advocating for leaving a species behind if, you know, it's endemic to one area or something. But we need to look more holistic, I think, at where a lot of this.
I mean, that was kind of the original thought behind a lot of the national park systems.
Yes.
And all that was so conserving those unique and rare ecosystems and biomes, because they knew it was a limited amount of it. And that benefited a whole lot of species.
It does. And we need to protect what is protected already at all costs. And, you know, we're getting into, we've heard in the past, you know, threats to reduce our number of, you know, national parks, or, you know, shrink it or allow for other uses on our national parks, drilling, fracking, et cetera. Like, we need to, it's a hard no, you know, and I know we need resources, but we also need to slow down on our use of those resources, you know, and think about the give and take, and that once it's gone, once it's done, it's it, you know?
Yeah. That's a whole other podcast we'll have to get into at some point. Was the, you know, the push right now in several states to, what's the word I'm looking for? They basically are wanting the federal government to get rid of these BLM lands.
Yeah.
Because they want it for development. And it's all greed, and it happens about every 10 years, comes around, yeah. It gets fought. Hopefully, we'll see the same thing happen, that, you know, people don't make that change. But you just never know. It's ridiculous that we have to do this fight every now and then.
Oh, I mean, I know.
They were set aside for a reason. You don't need a condo and a tennis court and a golf course. Sorry. No. You got plenty of them. So leave those public lands alone. But that's happens. Right. A lot. And there's a couple of states that are doing that now. That's a whole another podcast.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, a lot of those people that think it's a waste of space, or, you know, it needs to be developed, something needs to be happening on it all the time, haven't gone out. Maybe they haven't had the experience to go out and appreciate it for what it is. They don't camp. Yeah. They don't know birds. Maybe they hate it. I mean, I don't know how you do it. But I think, you know, we need to do a better job of getting those people out, helping them to appreciate what's out there, because, you know, maybe they don't, have never been out there. You know, how many landowners have we worked with that once they saw the camera down the burrow to see the tortoise, or we pointed out what birds they are, or handed them a plant list?
Yeah.
You know, they got excited that they had something that was rare on their property.
Yeah.
And it's on.
Yeah.
You know, where we thought they weren't going to work with us, they're calling us every other day, telling us what they found or how they can do more. Yeah. So it's just, our efforts need to get people out there.
And unfortunately, that's another catch-22, is getting people out of limited lands.
We found that in 2020, didn't we?
It hadn't ended.
No. But that's the other reason also. So there's a lot of studies, and we've talked about it in one of our first podcasts, about how important it is to be outside and how it's really good for your mental health. And a lot of people found that out in 2020 when they were stuck in their houses, or they, you know, couldn't work, they went outside. They started to appreciate the outside, which has led to a ton of people being out. You can't go on a national park now without a reservation. Your camping reservation has to be like a year in advance. Whenever they open it, there's wait lists. It's insane, which points to needing more land just for humans to enjoy.
Yeah.
Never mind the
sort of being overrun by all people.
I know. When we were in Colorado, it was funny watching people like get out and want to take selfies with the moose and everything. It's like people, the bison itself,
waiting for somebody to be attacked.
Absolutely.
It's gonna be a viral moment.
Yeah.
Yep. So yes, there's a lot of issues with, you know, conserving those large ecosystems, but it's definitely needed. And we talked, going through the rest of the issues, was, you know, we lack that implementation flexibility, but we've seen landowner agreements now. We got Safe Harbor, CCAs. Yep. I think there's one other thing that they can do in there to do what they call predictability. So it limits that take, so that landowners can do the management that they need to maintain the property, do that regular maintenance and management and activity. Yeah. And then if an animal or plant just happens to die because of, you know, just normal things, then they're not responsible.
Yeah. Cause it's good stewardship and stuff happens, you know, but at the flip side too, if you build it and they come, you know, you're still at that baseline of zero, and hopefully you feel the reward of that animal or whatever showing back up, or you finally cleared your woods and you're getting some awesome plants popping up.
Yeah. So basically, when you sign up for one of those agreements, whatever the population that you have at that moment, so if you had 2 red calcated woodpeckers, you signed up and you did great work and you've got 15 now, 13 of those die. Lord help us, that happened. Maybe had a hurricane came through and it wiped out, you know, the trees, but you're still only responsible for maintaining that 2.
Mm-hmm.
Is basically what it comes down to. And again, responsible activity. If the hurricane came through and wiped everything out, that's an act of God. There's, you know, it's not going to fall back on the landowner to, well, you killed all the birds because they didn't do it.
Right. And often, you know, having them get you help with management activities on your property. You can get help monitoring if you want to. You don't have to, but like burning and thinning and all sorts of stuff. There's a lot of programs out there to help.
Provide that money. Yep. Another thing is lack of state involvement because these are federal programs. So a lot of people complain that the states aren't really involved or allowed to be as involved as they need to be with the species that are occurring sometimes only in their state, or they're occurring on state lands, but they still have to follow all the federal mandates. And I think some of that has improved a little bit, but I think there's definitely some room for some growth within that as well. And then the last issue you see a lot of people mention, or we talked about a little bit, was economic interests, industry being able to do the things that they do. And that all goes back into, you know, that regulatory predictability, ESAs, safe harbor agreements, and all that kind of stuff. So there are things in place to allow reasonable activity.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you sometimes get, what we just talked about with the land, people get a little greedy with some stuff, and you know, you don't have to have that square foot right there.
Yeah.
There's plenty. And it's definitely, like I said, in the, you know, at the beginning, is the purpose of ESA was not to stop people from using the land or being able to, you know, make an economic return. It's just to protect the species that don't have a voice for themselves. So I guess to wrap up a little bit and talk about how these new changes that are coming or things that have happened or how the Endangered Species Act in general impacts landowners, to wrap it all together. We've touched on it a little bit already, but what are some positive things that you see? Some of these we'll probably restate. We talked about, you know, just people getting engaged and seeing, getting excited about the property because they have a species on it. But what are some other things you can think of that impact landowners positively or negatively?
Well, just the availability of more resources and more help. So, you know, professionals, wildlife professionals get more interested or happy to help with management plans or whatnot, connecting to resources, whether it's, you know, a good logging crew or, you know, good contractors to help you manage your property, helping you mark things, mark trees, mark like gopher tortoise burrows, you know, and I've even led bird tours, you know, taking Audubon groups out on landowners' property that, you know, they just really enjoy it. They enjoy the camaraderie. We used to have a landowner that would bring guests out to watch his RCWs at night. So, you know, it allowed for sharing and connection. So I think, you know, those are the non-monetary benefits, I think, sometimes.
But even monetize that. You could. Nowadays, which I just said earlier with some of the ecotourism of the birding.
Yeah, for sure.
Because people want to fill out their lifetime bird list, and, you know, an endangered species is one that's going to be hard to get.
Yep. I know some places have charged parking fees, you know, to come see a species. They've even enrolled in programs that, you know, you get paid to open up your property a certain time of year to the public to come bird watch. There's, you know, we got voluntary public access is what that ends up being. So you could use it to open up to hunting or whatever your activity you decide. But, you know, birding is always possible, or seeing, checking other things out.
Yeah. I think a lot of the Audubon groups were setting up programs where they would pay landowners to provide access to birders.
Yeah, I cannot remember the name of that program.
I know. Yeah, I should know it because I was just looking at it the other day. But, you know, there's definitely opportunities to turn that into an economic benefit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to make you rich, but, you know, provide a little bit extra. I got to pay the taxes on the property.
Yeah, but, I mean, speaking of offsetting, you know, enrolling in programs, there's so many programs to help you with your management that even if you are doing something good already, obviously you're doing something right if that species is there.
Right.
But there are programs available, and there's money available and people available to help you do even more, or just to maintain it, you know.
And I think we touched a little bit at the beginning too on, you know, as you protect these species, you get other benefits like water quality and air quality because you're improving the habitat for them. You're improving the habitat for you and all the other animals. Benefit of being outside and clean air.
We haven't even talked about the potential carbon market, you know, and that stuff's starting to come on. You know, so that'll be interesting to see where that goes also.
Yeah.
You know, putting land aside or enhancing what you're doing, and, you know, native ground cover, native grasses are, you know, great for carbon, sometimes better than some of the tree species we have in the ground.
Yeah, the root systems that these native grasses have are just insane, and people don't realize how much carbon they sequester in there.
So I think as science improves and we get more of a handle on exactly what the numbers look like, I think that's going to be a great economic source.
I think so too. I guess what was originally, or and maybe in some areas still could be, a negative for having some of these species, if you have timberland or, you know, something where you need to do some sort of land management, especially if it's a mechanical land management, it may be hard to find someone to, or at least used to, find someone who could do that within regulation and meet those regulatory requirements. But over time, obviously, that would go for tortoise, like marking burrows. There's a lot of logging crews now that understand what is required for gopher tortoises if you're doing logging within those areas.
Yeah, if you just talk to them ahead of time, and, you know, you might have to go out there a day and help the landowner mark things, but there are resources out there.
Yeah. So don't let the landowner shouldn't think, oh my God, I can't do anything now.
That's often the worst thing you can do. And we've seen that as people find that they have something and they just stop doing everything because they don't understand that you still do it. If you remember back in the day when we started all this stuff with gopher tortoises, they stopped thinning around gopher tortoise burrows. So all the trees would be growing up around the burrow, shading out the burrow, and the tortoises would be moving around into the spaces that they did manage because there was just miscommunication and fear there about how do I handle this. And I think and now we have a better handle on how to communicate that to people and to the logging crews, and
exactly.
There are ways around it.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, if you are in a situation where you're dealing with threatened or endangered species, there are those resources out there, and people have gotten really good at learning how to work around the different regulations and make it work for the landowner. Because again, that's the whole point. Don't be afraid to have that species, celebrate it, utilize it, and make it work for you. Because like you said, there's funding out there and there's a lot of resources. So that should not stop anyone from doing the activities that they normally do. That's just the way it goes. People sometimes get a little, what's the word I'm looking for, overly anxious, and they read into things that really don't exist. They're make mountains out of molehills.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes that's our fault as resource professionals, is how we approach and communicate things. You know, we just need to be more aware of how we handle it sometimes.
Yeah, and you know, newer people in the field may not understand how to work with some of the endangered species, and it does take a little bit of time to realize it. But there are people out there who've done this, and this is their primary jobs to do this. Reach out if you're a landowner with an endangered or threatened species. Reach out to someone, let them help you walk through that, and don't ignore it and be afraid of it.
Right.
That's a good thing.
Oh, yeah. It means you're doing something right.
That's right. And it benefits all the other species. So enjoy. Anything else?
Yeah, I think we've covered a lot.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of other successes that we could talk about. I know we were Southeast focused. So that's where we are. That's what we know.
Yeah. Yeah, tons and tons of species that, I mean, alligators, it can go into lots and lots of different species that were either protected from extinction or they may still be on the list for some reason or another, but they're definitely not extinct now. We've seen those numbers come up.
Usually if they stay on, it's just the lack of habitat and lack of multiple populations. You know, we just don't feel like we've hit that point yet for them to meet that, what we call minimum viable population.
Right. And like with alligators, I think they kept them on for quite a while because of another species that was similar, the crocodile, that a lot of people couldn't tell apart. So they left them to protect the other species. Mm-hmm. So weird things happen sometimes, but alligators, cranes, a lot of these things are now back able to be hunted. They're game species.
Yep.
So there are definitely some great successes out there.
For sure. Yep.
All right. Well, I think we've covered from one end to the other of a difficult conversation, and
that isn't so difficult.
Yeah, it really isn't.
It isn't.
If you stay out of the legalese end of it, it doesn't have to be that hard.
No.
It doesn't have to be scary. So until next time, we'll tackle some other crazy topic. And
yeah. Hopefully sooner.
Yeah, hopefully we won't be away quite as long. Until then, I guess subscribe and like, rate, and review, depending on whether you're listening or watching us.
And if you hate it and you can't listen past a minute, which you wouldn't have made it this far.
That's right.
Share it with someone. It must not be that bad.
That's right. Or it's just like a train wreck. You just cannot walk away from it.
That's completely possible.
Calvin is right on this podcast.
100%.
Yeah.
Squirrel.
That's right. Well, we appreciate it. And until next time, we'll see you. Thanks.